Nice message so far, and I'd like to bring up our next speaker, and it's James, and we're enthused to have you here. So light us up.
Good day, everybody. I'm a grateful drunk, and my name is James. It is because of God's grace and good people like yourself, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or drug any minor off the chemicals since June 11th of 1994, and for that I'm eternally grateful. And because of people like y'all, y'all remind me how I can't take no credit, and that bothers me sometimes. You know, I was thinking about what do you say to a bunch of people that more than likely, because of this process, have either come to know God and love AA. It is almost the feeling of being a preacher at a podium, and you're preaching to a congregation, and you turn back to the choir and say, "How y'all feel?" It's like, what do you say? Well, all I can do is do what the book tells me in the seventh chapter. I would like to have the time to sit down like I did with my brothers over at Carry the Message, and I ain't got a month. So, but what I'm going to do is, to the best of my ability, is to stress the spiritual feature as best as I know how, as it was revealed to me in the period of time that I have. And what simply took place was that I was the kind of person from 1980 to 1994 that came into places like this. And after a period of time, I can no longer differentiate the truth from the false. For I believed that my drinking life was the only normal one. And I would sit here and become restless, irritable, and discontent unless I can soon again feel a sense of ease and comfort that comes after taking a drink, a few drinks. And the reason that that came to mind is because I had an opportunity after a meeting. I met somebody in the place I love the best, and that's the parking lot. And we began to have a discussion about a story he felt I should hear and that he wanted to share with me. And what he shared with me was a story of a grandfather who for 30 years went without a drink. The man had, I guess, some heart problems, as his grandson was telling me the story. And he told me how he had a half a pint sitting of Seagram's whiskey. Now, in my generation, I don't remember Seagram's whiskey much. But to hear Seagram whiskey, and I went, I know Seagram's gin. I even know the VO. But I don't know much about the whiskey. So he's telling me the story, and he tells me the story, and he says, as the man begins to get closer, I guess, to whatever severe moment that was taking place, he said to his grandson, "Go in there and get the Seagrams and bring two glasses." The man was explaining to me that it appeared to him that his grandfather was having a heart attack and he was 30 years without a drink or whatever. And he said he poured the two drinks for him and his grandfather, and they took the drink, and shortly after that, the man passed. And the young man began to explain to me how this baffled him and how it confused him. And I sat there, and I don't know about the rest of you drunks, but the story didn't surprise me any. I didn't even, you know, I felt empathy, but I didn't feel any sympathy about the moment. And I understood it as if I was living the moment. And there was an identification. And what I mean by that is this. There is one thing without this process that I would want more than anything in this world, and that is to have a drink. I'm not going to stand here and paint this picture of you as if alcohol was the worst thing that ever happened to me. It wasn't. I was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Because if you're anything like I was, or what I could be again, was that alcohol did something for me before you guys carried that message to me. Alcohol carried a message too. For some apparent reason, no matter how bad things was in my past, alcohol tend to make it okay for the moment. When you hurt my feelings and I couldn't understand what it was that I did to you, when I would pour a drink, I would look for why it was that you were doing to me what it was you was doing to me as I looked in the glass. Y'all can't identify that. Y'all may also remember the times where you laid in your bed at night in a cold, dead sleep. And you're tossing and turning and the cool side of the pillow just ain't working. And you pop up out your sleep and you feel around on the corner of the bed. And you find it. And you crack the top. You take a big old mouthful and you swallow it. And you go down that little pipe. And it hit that bottom of your stomach. Boom! And you fall back on the pillow and say, "Phew." I guess y'all don't identify. Why am I talking about that? Because how many times have we, people like us, who know what the book has revealed to us, chapter 7 towards the end tell us that any time that we go around talking about alcohol badly, the newcomer won't stand for it. And the founders told us it's stupidity. Why is it stupidity? Because for years I sat in these rooms and people said things like this. I come to AA because booze stopped working. Page 53 said logic is good stuff. We like it. We still like it. And it talked about how I would not give myself over to reasonable interpretation or reasonable approach. So the first thought in my mind was when you said I came to AA because booze stopped working, the first thought in my mind was, why are you here? Why are you here? If you're sitting in an AA meeting wondering that I'm here because booze stopped working, then you may need to be an Al-Anon. That's the truth. I am an alcoholic. I am a real alcoholic. How do I know? Well, I suffer from a bodily problem that is so devastating, even the medical fraternity in 1939 had to say, it's a phenomenon. Medical fraternity today knows a little more about metabolism than they did in 1939, and they're still saying, it's a phenomenon. Because what alcohol does for me, it don't do for the regular world. Normal drinkers go out. They say, honey, would you like to go out to dinner tonight? She says, sure, hon. And he goes upstairs and he cleans up real good. And they go out to dinner and he has some pasta and some salad and maybe a glass of wine. And then they leave and go home and do what normal people do. I didn't do that at Olive Garden. How about you, Bill? I nibbled on the breadstick, and Mama said, can I get a doggy bag, and held me by the arm, and we went home. Normal people don't do that. I had my first drink when I was 9 years old, and I'm not going to take the advantage of an opportunity to speak and tell you that I became an alcoholic at 9 years old. Nope. I had my first drink based on something that I interpret. I had a grandfather I loved dearly. I was his namesake, and I was his oldest grandchild. And what happened was his grandpa used to go to work every day, and he had a special little chair that sat on the porch by the threshold of the door. He had one of them lamp tables, and he had one of those tin things cut in half that he used as an ashtray. And he came home one day and didn't feel like messing with me. And he went in the door and he came back out with his cigar, and he came out the door with this clear mayonnaise looking jaw. And he sat down, he lit that cigar, and when he lit that cigar, he took a couple of puffs, opened up that jaw, took a couple of gulps, and became this fun loving guy. We had a ball. A couple of days passed. He come home again. Same routine, you can almost set your clock to him. And what happened? Lit the cigar, took a couple of gulps. I guess he was physically tired that day, and he fell back in the chair. And I remember this feeling I felt. And in my mind, I remember how it changed him. So what did I do? At 9 years old, I went and grabbed a cigar. Then I said, well, that ain't work. So then I took his clear mayonnaise jar, and I opened it up. And I just threw it back, and I want to let you know, if you got any 9-year-olds at home, let them know that corn whiskey don't go down smooth. And from that day on out, I never drank for the taste. Never again drank for the taste. Because if there are any drunks in here and you ever went down south or happened to get lucky up this way and run across some corn whiskey, that's some good stuff. It don't come in, it'll come no purer than that. And what happened was, is that the next example that was sent to me was how humorous the so-called normal people thought it was that I put myself in that position to be dizzy. And they laughed and saw me puke, and they, nah, nah, you teach you a lesson, you little brat, you know, and I'm sick as a dog, and it wasn't cute. Now, I'm going to start speeding up after this. Now, I want to take you back to a scene so you can understand what I consider my alcoholism, because I just told you about my first time consuming alcohol. And there's sometimes this confusing thing that goes on in the rooms, because on one hand, we talk about alcoholism, and on the other hand, we forget to talk about alcohol. Because, see, alcohol will kill you if you're a real alcoholic. Alcoholism will beat you up emotionally, spiritually, and mentally if you're not physically drinking alcohol. Now, once I start physically drinking alcohol, I don't care how you think, feel, or believe. And I don't even care how I do, because alcohol worked for me. It's not working for me now, but it worked. That's why when the program started to work, I became recovered from a seamlessly hopeless state of mind and body. Now, from the ages of 3 till I was 9 years old, I was raised by this grandmother. That's how I stumbled into Grandpa and his activities and became his pet. Around the age of 10, this is where I believe my defectiveness started to kick in. Because between 9 and 10 and a half years old, when Grandma passed away about close to 30 years or so ago, what happened was, at this point now, I'm not drinking, but the things by which I should be developing and understanding, I am not. And I was introduced to one of the first four horsemen, terror. How did I come across that? I came home from school one day, and Grandma knew I had homework, and I had a routine. I would sit, kneel down at the coffee table in front of the TV, which was my privilege as long as I was doing my homework. Grandma had an asthma attack. She asked me to go get her a cup of coffee. Now I understand why she used to tell me to go get her coffee when she had an asthma attack. For some reason, caffeine, blah, 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 whatever. And I went in there and I got it and I brought it back to her. As I knelt down to do my homework, my grandmother was sitting there watching me. I just looked over at it, nothing was happening, and I just kept going. And I sat there for a while doing my homework, and I got up and I tapped Grandma, and the coffee spilled in her lap, and she didn't move. I didn't get kicked, slapped, you know, cussed out or whatever. I knew something was wrong. And I felt pure unadulterated terror. Guess what? I ain't an alcoholic yet. So I tear off out the house in pure bedevilment. Don't have an idea. I'm bewildered. I'm terrified. And I just run to one place I knew a person could help me. That was my great uncle. They get me back. They say, Grandma died. Now, they telling me that I gotta go to my mother or my father, and I don't know neither one of them. So what's the next thing I feel? Fear. I'm frightened to death because I don't know my mama or my daddy. I don't know them. I ain't talking about alcohol. I'm talking about how I was emotionally stricken before booze started working. So between the ages of 10 and 13 years old, I ended up in a wonderful community called Jersey City. It wasn't necessarily Mayberry. And it was totally culture shock for me because at this time, I was being raised by my grandmother. We went from South Carolina to a place called Wilmington, North Carolina. I mean, the beach was just minutes away. I grew up in this nice household with grandma. Now I'm in a cold water flat with my mama, with three other siblings. So now, terror, fear, bewilderment, and guess what's kicking in now? Frustration. Because I would get confused at the fact that when mama was around and my sisters and them was there, they were interested in mama telling them who I was, how I was going to fit into the family. And as soon as mama left the room, they would estrange themselves to me. And I would be confused about that, and I was frustrated, and I couldn't understand why y'all act like y'all scared of me. Why y'all don't want to play with me? If you think I'm kidding, I'll give you a perfect illustration before man and God. If you ever grew up in the hood, we had a wonderful event in the summertime called the ice cream truck. Eddie Murphy made a joke out of it, but it's true in the hood. Hot summer day in the hood, it's hot. There ain't no trees, and there ain't no wonderful parks, you know, and stuff like that. You running up and down the sidewalk playing tops and all kinds of stuff. And the ice cream truck came. And all the kids tear down the block to get money from the adults. Now, the adults are sitting on the stoop drinking their beer, sipping their stuff, and we run down the street to get change. As I'm in the crowd of kids working my way to the grown-ups to get my change, my uncles and them are handing out 50 cents and dollars, and all of a sudden I'm walking up, and they just take their money, fold it, put it back in their pocket. And I'm thinking, what about me? And then I looked up, and my Aunt Janet was in the window. And I love her to death, still to this day. I love my Aunt Janet about as much as I say I love my mother. My Aunt Janet called me upstairs, and she had a pint or half a gallon of ice cream, and she'd give me a spoon and share with me. And from that point on out, I became lonely. Like I felt detached, even from my immediate family. I got a friend in the audience today to tell you I'm still estranged to my family. A lot of them are still living in these urban industrial communities, and for those who don't understand what I'm saying, they're still in the hood. Not out because they have to be, because of choice. I'm not saying that there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying it's bad to be attached to your community or whatever. But because of that, I don't find this like, if I don't have my family in my life, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because, see, everything that I thought I had lost, God gave me back. Like I told you, I never knew my father. God gave me a man who became my surrogate dad, who helped me to become the man that I am. God gave me a bunch of brothers and sisters like yourself, who I'm real close to, that when I see you, I feel just as close to you as I feel to a sister or a brother, if not closer. Now, I understand that right now, so far, some might be wondering, where the alcohol fit in at? We're about to get there. I was 13 years old at a public swimming pool, Montgomery Street under the turnpike, and we swimming. And like good ghetto kids, afterwards we get on our shorts and we're going back down the street. And all of a sudden there was a social club right across the street from the apartment building we lived in, my mother used to frequent. And we noticed that there's an ambulance down there, so we take off running down there. Sure enough, they bring a woman out on a stretcher. Her hair is everywhere, and it's my mom. Somebody found it was necessary to slip a Mickey in a drink, and it snapped her mind. My mother ended up in Trenton State Institution for over a year. The wonderful state of New Jersey decided to put me and three other siblings under the care of an 18-year-old illiterate young lady who did not know how to manage a family. So we went through the good stuff, like neglect, squalor, poverty, all that good stuff, abuse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the reason I'm telling you that, because, see, I like telling alcoholics, because, see, y'all don't care. But I used to work a psychoanalyst. Woo! I need some more of that. Raise the dosage. Oh, James, it'll be my pleasure. How many milligrams? You know, psychoanalysts, I have nothing against. I really don't. They came in handy now, but before they really got used by me like most people. And because of that tragedy in my life, I became a taker of a thing and a user of people. Because now I met my best friend, anger. He was like a cozy blanket. A lot of people, I sit in meetings and I hear people say,
is there a topic tonight?
Yes, anger. And in my mind, God forgive me, in my mind I'm saying, why don't you just choose self-pity? Because that's what's underlining it in my case. The reason I was so angry is because I was so pitiful. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Between the ages of 13 and 15 years old, my heroes became the pimp, players, and hustlers. Why? I never seen them go to work. They always had the nicest of clothes, the best jewelry, prettiest girls, and everybody respected them. I figured, ooh, that'll work. So they ended up, you know, making me their little junior. Hey, man, here's $5. Go down the street. And I said, wow, this is cool. So they became my heroes. And by this time, I'm tricking the winos, not really tricking them. You know, we had a little thing in the hood. The way we used to get drinks underage was we used to tell the winos, look, man, go in there and get me two quarts. Because back then, we had quarts. We didn't have 40s. Yes. And I would send them in there for whatever I needed to drink. And we would buy them a bottle of wine. They go get us whatever we want. Now, to let y'all know how I know I'm a real alcoholic, this is how I came to realize that. And I ain't realized it then, but I know now that that was the day that I became an alcoholic. I was 15 years old in sophomore year school, Snyder High School, and me and some buddies got together and we started buying all this liquor. You probably heard me talk about this. If you heard one of my tapes, I had some time to really get into it. And what happened was me and some buddies went to the store. We got everything. Gin, vodka, bourbon, you name it. We had it all, beers, some chemicals. And we went to the tracks, and we started to drink. And I noticed that in the crowd, when I look back at the story, and I share it today, I look back at that, and I could see how I was different a drinker than they were. For example, there were some people that strictly stayed to the gin. There was another crowd that only wanted to drink beer and have some chemicals. And then there were some people that would have some beer and some liquor. Me? Give me a little bit of that. You gonna drink that? Can I have a puff of that? Give me a few of those, you know? And what happened was, it was a June day, and I'm walking down the street in the dead of summer, and it's blazing. And I don't know how I got home. Now, y'all told me that was a blackout. I kind of took that personal. I'm a kid. I stumble home, somehow I get there, and I pass out in the hallway, and I found myself laying in my own regurgitation. This is why I'm a cheerleader for two things, God and AA. Because I was 15 years old, laying at the bottom of the steps with my head propped up on the bottom step. And if it wasn't for that step and the position that I was in, I probably would have drowned in my own regurgitation. My mother and my aunt come downstairs. They see me laying at the bottom of the step. They get me up out my puke, and they get me upstairs. They get me cleaned up, and they, you know, they gave me the old, you know, finger motion thingy, and they put me in a little punishment and told me how stupid that was, what I did, and I felt sick as a dog. But what I didn't tell them was I was feeling some things and that this stuff that I was drinking was working. And that's why I think I started drinking, because of my defective traits. Because I had a lot of emotions going on inside me, and the people that were in my life was inequipped to see what I was, where I was heading. Because most of them were drinking heavily. Like it says on page 31, I am not here to pronounce anybody in this room an alcoholic. Now, the only reason I describe my mama as an alcoholic, because my mama used to say when she used to get mad, yeah, I'm drunk. I don't care. Now, I remember saying that. So sometimes you hear me talk about my mother. I said my mother was an alcoholic and a schizophrenic. Because only, you know, most of us drunks, when we were drunk, and somebody said, you've been drinking? Yeah, I was drinking. We never was afraid to tell somebody we were drinking. We didn't want you to catch us while we were drinking because we like to be interrupted. The thing that I had to think about that one a minute myself. The where I'm trying to go, and I'm going to start getting into some stuff. Between 15 and 18, that progressed. And at 18 years old, in 1980, I was working for an independent soda distributor who gave me my first full-time job. And at 18 years old, we were delivering some stuff, some soda that day to a bodega that happened to sell liquor and other things. And I knew inside myself that morning that we were going there and that I could get some alcohol because the guy didn't mind, like, slipping me a little shorty in the morning. And I'm sitting there, we riding, and Nick's driving. He looks over, and he noticed I'm 18 years old, and I got this morning thing going. My hands trembling early in the morning. Hands are clammy. You know that y'all don't know? Y'all kind of quiet. Nick called me on my stuff, and he said, "You look like you need some help." And in 1980, I was introduced to AA for the first time. Now we speed up. From 1980 to 1994, I was what most AA people call a chronic relapser. That's why when this last time around, when people would say, "Just don't drink and go to meetings," I used to get angry. Because after you have done it a few times and it had fell short, each time I heard it, it only angered me a little bit more. I used to sit in meetings and hear relapsers say, "Oh, it gets tougher each time I come back." And I would look at them and go, "That ain't what you really wanted to say. What you really wanted to say is, I came back because I had no place else to go. I knew y'all was going to point your finger at me and say, 'Did it again, didn't you?'" I had old timers during my relapsing periods where I used to go up to them and say, "You be my sponsor." They used to look at me and say, "Come back when you're serious." And then they got mad at me when y'all introduced me to this process. Any big book people in here? Yeah, I've been to some of the meetings, right? And I tell you how y'all know. Remember when y'all walked in, they went, "Oh, boy. I see Bill hand up. Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead, Mike. Share. Go ahead. You know. Or they'll see your hand up and they'll look right at you and then look at somebody who hands down and go, "Would you like to share?" Anybody know about that? So don't y'all be so quiet. Because if I'm correct, I was told that this was a celebration meeting. So let's celebrate. And the reason we celebrate is because I believe God shows up where he celebrated. He do. From that time, I went through a pain that only God could help me with. Here we go. I got back here this last time, and I was sharing with a gentleman prior to the meeting. If you look at the comments, I got to get this right before I go there. The big book is where I work the steps. The 12 and 12 is my commentary. I work the steps from the book, and I get a little more insight from the 12 and 12. Because how do I apply since man crushed grapes? But I can apply men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. And if I'm willing to admit that, then I'm on my way. So like it said in the commentary, what helped me was it told you in the commentary, give you several different descriptions of how we get here. That's all it is. I was talking to the gentleman earlier, and you know how a lot of times you go into these just don't drink and go to meetings? And they look at the steps on the wall and start to interpret them, and while they're sharing, they go, "And I was looking at the steps on the wall." And, you know, we smart butts as big book people, so I'm thinking that's what you got, an off-the-wall program, you know. And a good friend, Howard, used to make me laugh when he used to say that. I love that. They say if you use it more than three times, you can claim it. And And they sitting there, and they want to sound real profound, and they want us to feel as if their comment is going to have a certain degree of impact on me, and they don't fail to understand that I'm selfish and self-centered, even though I don't think so. I don't care about what his old purple lip butt talking about, because it don't make any sense to me. And I'm going to tell you why. Because they would look at it and say,
yeah, when I look up at the wall, I see that, you know, the word to stick out in my first step is we. I go, brilliant.
In my mind, I'm being honest with y'all. You know, like I said, when I go visit the brothers that carry the message group, like I say to Brother Bill and a few people that know me when we talk and park a lot, I'm going to tell you what I really believe and what I see. I don't come to AA to share my opinion, strength, and hope, just my experience. And my experience has been I've heard some things that made me scratch my head. That's why I ain't got no hair. Here's what happened. So I was sharing with the brother. I was sharing with the brother, and what happened was, he was telling me about how, you know, like a lot of people look at the word we. And I said, you know why the word we works for me? Because when I look at me and I look at every drunk in this room, I know that every single person in here got their butt whipped by alcohol. So when I start talking about what booze did to me, it'd be no more different than when I was 5 or 6 years old and we all was a group of people who had the bully take our nickel. Meet me over at the seesaw. He took your nickel this morning too? And the first one of us that get a message that tells us we no longer have to allow him to take our nickel anymore, meet me over at the swings. I found out that you ain't got to let him take your nickel no more. You ain't got to let booze kill you. You don't have to. How do I know? Because when you read the doctor's opinion towards the end, they tell you about a man that he saw, and he said he couldn't recognize him. He looked familiar, and there he was, brimming over with confidence. So when those big books people walk into a meeting, they go, look at him, they're cocky. And I get that feeling inside, would you like a drink? I know you will feel better. But they don't want to drink, and we know that that's true. How do we know that? We have an example of more about alcoholism, of a man being sober for 25 years or more. And willpower, we always have willpower. You know how much willpower it takes to take a drink in the morning and feel like you want to regurgitate it and grab your own mouth to keep from drinking, from letting it go? I used to hold my booze down. You know what kind of willpower it takes to go? And not do it once. Again and again and again till I can experience a psychic change. Bill didn't say until I experience a physical change. He said a psychic one. My mind changed. I sit in meetings, I hear people say, Bill, I love the fact that he introduced us the idea that the mental obsession was the one thing that we fought the most. I got a new obsession. It's called AA. Program. I'm obsessed with it to the point that some people don't like me. There he go again. That's fine. But for a long time, I let that discourage me. Now, I know I ain't got much time, but like I told y'all, I didn't have enough of time to talk about every little single episode that happened in my life. But I do have enough of time to tell you how excited I am about AA. I'm so excited about AA, I got in my truck and drove from Middlesex County to come and hang out with a bunch of drunks. Now, you got people that might ask us in the normal world, you going where? For what? Just to tell them I don't drink no more. Why can't they come to you? I don't know. But I do know. I do know. I have a desire to be where you at. Especially you thumpers. I like to always talk about the lady who one time said, you know what?
You're a big book Nazi.
And I looked at it and said, I'm not what Hitler had in mind. I had an old timer walk up to me one time. He said, with that attitude you got, you'll never see 30 years like me. I said, hell, when I get 30 years, your old butt won't be around you to see it anyway.
Had one poke me in the chest. I spilt more than you ever drank.
I said, well, if you'd have drank it rather than spill it, you'd have got your old butt here sooner. Why did I share that with y'all? I'm going to tell you why I shared it. Are you happy? Are you joyous? And can the big book, 12-step people say they free? I'm free. I owe you nothing. I owe anybody any money? And if I do, I don't know if I get to you anyway. My sponsor fixed that, though. The reason I say that and the reason I'm talking about that is because we take a beating. I was one of those early jokers back about 10 years ago when people like us would talk. And we almost felt like we wasn't allowed to go to that meeting anymore. And we thirst and hungered for what we have tonight. We're popular now because of good men and women like yourself, like Barefoot, Mike, and my old mentor, Nelson, who passed away, and a few other people I know like them. The ones that kept coming to the meeting every week that said, you can find the message in the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you have some puke next to you talking about, don't listen to him. He don't know what he's talking about. All you got to do is just let it go. I wanted to really let it go, you know what I mean? Because I needed more. I was physically powerless over alcohol. I suffered from a mental obsession that placed me in a dilemma. And therefore, I lacked the power to believe that there was something different. Roland Hazard was given that example when he was told about a few people who may be able to give him the experience that he needed. Our solution is simple. It is no more than a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. And our more religious members like myself call it a God consciousness. And I got mine over the educated variety. Though as an African-American descent growing up in the Judeo-Christian charismatic atmosphere, I never had a problem with God. Never had a problem with God. I just figured he couldn't catch me. Some more of my Catholicized friends might have been fearful they were going to die and go to hell or the nun hit them a little too hard. But whatever reason I failed to come to believe, at some point I did because of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous told me on page 52 that I was full of fear. I couldn't make a living. I couldn't even control my own emotional nature. You know, they talked about I suffer from things called bedevilments and stuff like that. And then I come to realize that if I was willing to turn my thinking and the way that I was living, which is I've made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking and my life over to the care of God, meaning the way that I live day by day. And today I became a conducive and productive member of the community by which I live in and the community by which I hang in. And like my brother said earlier, I too am a homeowner. And I suffered from pure dereliction. I was homeless for a long time. God is good, not just on Mondays and Tuesdays either. The fourth step gave me an opportunity to take a look at myself, but it was only a look. Because Bill told me in interaction that written self-appraisal would be insufficient without me making that next step, which was the confession of what I just wrote, and to tell you the exact nature of the wrong. My defective character has not always had to stay the same. I got new defects now. I do. My old defects was I used to be envious, jealous, mad, angry, and frustrated at those developing in a progressive manner outside of me. Today, my defective traits is, please don't take away from me what I got, which we know that's my chief activator. So I have to humbly ask God to remove that kind of stuff from me, and I can't hold back nothing. I can't hold back the fact that, God, I'm living better than I ever lived in my entire life. Please don't let me lose this. I love coming home to a woman that loved me and kids that almost respect me. And the reason I said almost is because if y'all was anything like I am, y'all know we on a long road. Big book people know that. Because the family afterwards says the family feels as if they have a mortgage on dad. And I like to say and mom. But he tells us, it's okay to keep your head in the clouds with him, but keep your feet firmly planted on the ground. Y'all know the program works. And the bottom line is now that we're popular, don't let ourselves be like Bill was and Bob had to remind Bill. Let's stay away from the Freudian things. Keep it simple. It works. It really does. What works? Open your book. Let's start. You'll find out. I got a result as the steps was unfolded to me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. A result. All my life, I got hope out of people. Every time I came in here amongst you, you gave me hope. But a sponsor taking me through the steps allowed me to have an opportunity where I got results. I had an opportunity to have a man from this group call me and ask me to do something that our service manual said it was okay to do, to allow me the opportunity to come and participate. There was times I wasn't even allowed to participate at dinner with the family. And then to have a few strangers ask me to come and partake of a celebration with them. Man, I'm excited about this thing. So, you know, in closing, I just want to tell everybody, you know, don't be afraid to walk and stand firm. The book told us there's some wrongs we can never fully make right. And nowadays, it might not be the past stuff that we dealt with, because if you work these steps, you made some amends. You took a look at yourself. You know that the 10th step ain't a go-to-bed step. It's a walk-around step. You know, you got people telling people in meetings, man, the 10th step, you deal with that at night when you go home. The 11th step is like that. I go to bed at night with the 11th step and think about how constructive I could be the next day. My 10th step says prompt. I can't kick you in the shins and wait 3 days to decide, oh, I was wrong for kicking him in the shins. That ain't prompt. That's a procrastinator. Bill said, how can we talk prudence when we practice evasion? I stopped practicing evasion. There ain't nothing wrong with people that love the big book. There ain't nothing wrong with people that believe in sponsorship. There ain't nothing wrong with people that believe that a 12-step call don't mean that somebody got to die while others live. How can you 12-step a corpse? This is a serious thing. As I always like to say when I close my mouth or get about to close my mouth, because we're going to probably hold a few of y'all hostage. But the truth of the matter is, if I have said or done or behaved in a manner tonight which is unacceptable, I ask your forgiveness. And the reason that I do that at the end of my sharing is because I'm just a human being who can have human moments that will express himself according to how I feel. I'm real excited. Y'all made me excited. Do you know what it takes to drive from Middlesex County in the rain to get to Bergen County? And I even have proper directions. But here's the kicker. Suddenly God did for me what I could not do for myself. And he gave me a brother in recovery that had visited this meeting before. And on the way here, he said, meet me here, and you can follow me in. So suddenly, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Hey, guys, it's in the book. It's in the steps. And as Bill says, may the good Lord keep you and bless you till the next time we meet. My name is James, and I'm a grateful drunk.
Want to thank everybody for coming tonight, and just briefly, real quick, there's a Ford station wagon parked at the end of the street. The police said they're going to have to tow it.